No life has been more rock and roll than Clapton's in his epic consumption of drugs and alcohol. His insatiable appetite for expensive cars, clothes and women most famously revealed when he fell in love with Patty Boyd, the wife of his best friend George Harrison, and the inspiration for that track Layla. With the benefit of his brilliant knowledge of 60s music and culture and of unrestricted access to family members, close friends and fellow musicians, including Clapton's ex-wife Patty Boyd and his longtime manager Roger Forrester, Philip Norman has written Slow Hand, the life and music of Eric Clapton, a definitive portrait of an insecure, often pain-racked man, a self-admitted egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and a rock legend whose life story is remarkable as his music. Delighted to join me live on the line from the UK, Philip Norman. Philip, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's surprising, isn't it? You think that he, you know, for a man who has been referred at various times through his career as God, we know remarkably little about the real Eric Clapton.
He has managed to keep his amazing private life very private, and he's been very lucky as well. He's really avoided a lot of the traps and pitfalls that major rock stars go through, like, you know, terribly expensive divorces or lawsuits against his record company or embarrassing children or horrible kiss-and-tell memoirs by ex-mistresses. He simply has avoided them.
But when you think about it, I mean, it's not to mean he's had a quiet life. I mean, his life has been marked with tragedy, with triumph, with addictions, with divorces, as we've said before. You know, it's not as if he hasn't gone through these trials and tribulations.
No, he's really, it's the ultimate rock star life, which, you know, of sex, drugs and rock and roll in his case, which he survived with a constitution probably only sort of rivaled by, you know, the great Winston Churchill, and or Keith Richards maybe.
Yes.
And he's in the end has sort of experienced redemption. So it, you know, it is a very complete story that ends on an up note.
Indeed, I mean, it is a story of redemption and coming back from the brink. How did it all start then? And what is your starting point for this particular? Because there have been books about Clapton before, but never as well researched as perhaps as this one.
Thank you. Well, his own autobiography seemed to be very confessional, but actually skated so quickly over everything, you hardly realise what he was saying. Mm. And some of it is really dreadful. I mean, the depths of his addiction, first to heroin and then to alcohol, which went on much longer than heroin. It all started with the blues. This rather sort of insecure boy in a village in Surrey heard the blues, and that completely, you know, this music of, you know, very poor black slaves, people, you know, terribly oppressed people in the southern states of America, just found this answer in this English boy, and the blues is what transformed him, and in the end what he brought into rock and roll.
I mean, I've read Clapton's autobiography, and, you know, his mother was incredibly young when she had him. He was brought up by the family. I mean, he had a heart, he had a seemingly, it's not a hard background, but definitely an unusual one.
It's very much like John Lennon. A lot of these big stars grow up with, you know, without a mother's influence. And a mother's influence can be about discipline as well as love and, you know, and giving values. And like John Lennon, Eric felt he lacked a mother. His mother was very cold and distant. He had to pretend she was his older sister because she'd had him out of wedlock. And so he, on the one hand, he felt deprived. On the other hand, he was very spoilt, just like John Lennon.
And when did the music then, how did he discover the guitar, and when did this talent, this amazing talent for, you know, as possibly one of the greatest white men ever to play the blues, become apparent?
Yes, in fact, one of the greatest to play the blues, because all his blues mentors, masters, exemplars, B.B. King, Muddy Waters, in the end said, this boy from Surrey is better than we are. He did it just by sheer dogged application, by listening to the records. He never had a guitar teacher. He taught himself by listening to records, by absolute dogged concentration.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, that early 60s period when you have the music coming from the Georgia cotton fields and out of the, you know, the steel mills of Chicago, and it finds a spiritual home in the art schools of Surrey and London. And you think about the Stones, who are influenced by John Mayall, of course, who becomes a massive influence.
It's funny, yes, the Thames, the, you know, the sedate suburbs of the River Thames become like a new Mississippi Delta. You know, there are so many schools and art schools along there where these all these different boys are wanting to play the blues. Blues, which was a sort of poor people's music, an itinerant people's music, turns into this big commercial sort of proposition in the UK. And of course, Clapton is always regarded, and you know, from a very young age, as being the absolute ultimate practitioner.
I've just got this idea of the Thames being the Mississippi Delta and Eel Pie Island being some sort of like some sort of Mississippi thing that just tickled my fancy. It was very apparent quickly that he was going to be a big star. You know, he joins the Yardbirds, that then splits to is the nucleus for so many other groups and gives us obviously Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. He leaves these bands though on his own terms. He goes from this to Cream and then to the ultimate super group.
Yes, he always walks away because you know the band he's in doesn't measure up to his sort of idea of the purity of the blues. And of course, the ultimate is Blind Faith, which is like a super duper group of all these other sort of stars of other groups getting together with Clapton. But actually, in the end, it has, the expectation is too much. The band implodes. I mean, after a single American tour.
I mean, how does Clapton, because there's the famous, you know, playing Layla and Derek and the Dominos, there's this famous Clapton is God, the graffiti starts to appear and this legend starts to build up. Does Clapton then turn to sort of drug and alcohol to cover to deal with the fame and keep away from the fans?
He's always sort of addictive. I mean, even as a small boy, he's obsessive. His grandmother, who has to pretend is his mother, he won't eat his breakfast cereal unless she pours the milk into the bowl from a certain angle. You know, he's always obsessive. He's obsessive about cycling or about clothes. But also he has this very funny sort of dual attitude to fame. He's surrounded by people who are protecting, doing everything for him, roadies and gophers and managers. And yet he really wants to be just a bloke in a band. He wants to be just a sideman. His great, great hero above all the blues masters is Robert Johnson, this young man who died at the age of 27, which Clapton was lucky not to do. Robert Johnson was so humble that his few recording sessions, he was too embarrassed to look at the engineer, so he looked at the wall. I mean, so that's really Clapton's sort of dual personality of humility and, you know, megalomania.
And he becomes, you said he becomes an almost an honorary member of both the Stones and the Beatles, a neat trick to pull off if you can do it.
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, you know, the only outsider of those incredibly tightly knit bands let in as an official, nearly official member.
And then, of course, there is the I played Layla as an intro to this interview, but there's we're talking about his addictive personality, you know, with the drugs, with the alcohol, but also with the women. And there is this, you know, the story, the famous story of Patty Boyd.
That's his wife's, his best friend's wife, George Harrison's wife, who he pursues for years because Patty doesn't want, you know, wants to make a go of the marriage with George. George, unfortunately, becomes unpleasant after he learns to meditate. It's supposed to give him inner peace, but he becomes horrible. And that eventually drives Patty into Eric's arms. And Eric, having pursued her all that time, once she comes to him, he doesn't want her anymore. It's like the guitars when he's young. He pines for a guitar. When he gets it, doesn't want it anymore.
Well, how were the 70s then to Clapton? And did he start to get a handle on his addictions? Because he developed a pretty unhealthy heroin habit by this point.
He got free of heroin and managed to stay off heroin. But, of course, alcoholism was much more serious. He bounced straight out of heroin addiction into alcoholism, and that lasted 2 decades. And it was only really the death of his 4-year-old son, a dreadful, dreadful accident, that made him absolutely determined to persevere with cleaning up from alcoholism.
Because this was one of the things, wasn't it? Because he'd got through the 70s, he'd got clean of heroin, and it was one of the turning points that when Connor was born, he had decided that he was going to try and be a grown-up now.
That's right. The real life only really caught up with him when he had a child. For a time, he didn't really, you know, take his responsibilities as a father very seriously. But he was just, this is the awful thing, he just started to get to know this utterly sort of enchanting little boy, Connor, when this awful accident happened and Connor fell out of a window on the 53rd floor of a New York high-rise building. And that was really the first time that real life had sort of slapped Eric, you know, really hard. And he had to become a grown-up, and he did.
And he wrote Tears in Heaven, which became a monster hit, and at the same time, he had this MTV Unplugged appearance, which, if you like, reintroduced him to his core audience and put him through to an audience perhaps who weren't familiar with his songs in this style.
Yes, I mean, it was one of the dreadful ironies. It's almost like one of those Dickensian short stories where, you know, someone wishes for something and then the wish is granted in a dreadful way. His song, Tears in Heaven, became, you know, the most successful track that he'd ever recorded. God knows how he got through singing it in the recording studio and afterwards, which he did many, many times. And, you know, it gave him an armful of Grammys.
How do you then, because obviously you've got a knowledge of this and you know, you know, people from your previous books, how do you approach writing about somebody who has been written about in so many ways? And I agree with you about his autobiography, because he skates over the last chapter when he says, "I'm now happily married and everything's going fine." How do you start with, and how willing are people to talk to you about Clapton?
Well, I always wonder how I'm going to start every time. Obviously, I've built up, you know, a very large circle of friends and acquaintances, my other books. And in this case, I had the cooperation of the former Patty Boyd, very generously and in great detail, his former manager. So I don't take anything for granted. I don't take anything that's been written as having been true, because generally the standard of these biographies is really very low, or autobiographies. So I really start from the beginning, and I try to put something new on every page of the book, which, of course, is a very tall order.
And define Clapton, because there are so many angles to his life, so many aspects, so many periods of the life. The talent is obviously is God given, if you like, but the fact that he's still with us and now is, you know, he's opened his own clinics and it's Antigua, isn't it? I think is his clinic said. Do you think this is the amazing thing, his legacy, is he's still with us?
Absolute yes. I mean, you know, it's almost a kind of badge of sort of immortality for rock stars to die at the age of 27, like Jimi Hendrix did or Jim Morrison. The fact that he has survived is extraordinary. All the hazards that usually afflict those kind of people, and of course, they can't stop doing music. They're made of music.
What do you think, looking at going through his life in music, what do you think his legacy will be? The greatest exponent of British 60s blues?
I think someone who lived the rock and roll life to the absolute ultimate, especially in the 60s, which, as we know, is a decade that fascinates people who weren't alive and their parents often weren't alive in the 60s. I just think it's the ultimate 60s fable.
The book is called Slow Hand, The Life and Music of Eric Clapton. It's out now by Winefield and Nicholson. It's by Philip Norman. Philip, if people want to find out more about you or by the book, is there social media? Do you have a website? How can they find you?
I don't have a website. I have enough to do writing for money.
It's quite all right. The book will be available as a download on the TRE bookshop. We'll take you to the right links. It only begs the question, Philip. I mean, you've done this sort of thing before to great effect. What's next in your sights?
Well, I said I was out. That was it. I was like Michael Corleone, you know, I was going to leak, get away from the mafia or get away from rock star writing. But I seem to have been sort of find myself doing Jimi Hendrix, which I'm doing. And it is a fascinating story. And here I go again.
Well, I look forward to speaking to you about that one as well. It's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning. Philip Norman, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.